The Optimal Life.
So it's Florence Ann. In case anyone ever interviews you and they come and watch this, you don't even have to ask her now. Just it's Florence Ann. She doesn't go by just Florence. Welcome. How are you?
I'm so great. I'm so happy to be here. I laugh because it is the most popular question, my name, if I'm saying my middle name when I say Florence Ann. But, you know, the world today, I feel like everyone has such unique names at this point. I think I was ahead of the curve.
You sure were. You sure were.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your grandparents. Who were they to you?
Oh, that is my favorite topic I could ever talk about. So I am from an old school Italian family. My mom's parents lived with us growing up, my Nana and Papa. And the name that we were just talking about comes from my Nana. She was Florence. So they really were kind of the drumbeat of our family, the heartbeat of our family. And, you know, you hear that proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. And back in the day, it used to be that we were all part of these immense villages, that we were part of, you know, these family units that were very solid and tight, and you depended on them. But as society has evolved, we don't really have the same attachment to our villages that we did before, but I kind of came from that old school mentality of village and cousins and family. And my grandparents were at the helm of that.
They had a profound impact on you.
Absolutely.
That's really nice when you see that kind of relationship between a grandparent and a grandchild, because, I just look at my parents with my kids. They've got such a beautiful relationship. It's like, and I remember my relationship with my grandparents. I mean, it's a bond that you just, it's different than a parent child relationship.
It is.
It's a different bond. Absolutely. They spoil you too. I mean, it's a whole different thing.
This, someone said recently that it's more fun to, not necessarily, you know, you love raising your children, but it's fun to be a grandparent because you get to do it all over again, but not the responsibility of actually raising them.
Absolutely. How did you get the nickname? I know you don't really go by it anymore, but the Windy City Nanny.
I still love that. It brings a lot of nostalgia. So I was a nanny for over 15 years in my former life, as I like to say. And so I hail from Chicago. Still, I'm born and raised in Illinois, I should say. I was born and raised in a suburb outside of Chicago. But when I was in that kind of nanny career, I got to work with so many different families. I got to be a part of so many different dynamics and rhythms. And that's really, I think, where I started to become very observant about human nature and the dynamics of families and what does support look like and connection look like. But after I retired from being a nanny, and I always quote Mary Poppins, quote is, "I stay until the wind changes." And the wind always changes for a lot of different reasons. But then I went off and started a business in digital content, but at the same time also wrote a children's book to help children understand the transition of being cared for by their parents to being cared for by a nanny or a caretaker. And so I started doing a lot of media surrounding childcare in the new millennium, and the media kind of nicknamed me the Windy City Nanny.
Oh, there you go. Well, is it true that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down? Is that right?
As
there?
An Italian, we would say anything that helps you take your medicine, whether it's sugar, a bowl of pasta, whatever it is that you need, you just do that, whatever it takes.
Yes, no doubt about it. So you mentioned village already, and you mentioned attachment. And I think that this is all ties to kind of what's become your mission. Mm-hmm. is helping other people and mm-hmm. helping them really create a community, build mm-hmm. a village. It takes mm-hmm. a village, as you say, and as everyone always says, it takes a village. But how do you get to that village, right? I mean, how did you come up with this idea and thought process, and where did this all begin?
Well, I love the proverb, "It takes a village to raise a child." We all understand it, you know, that makes sense, but I felt that it was very limiting. Because what happens if you don't have kids? Does that mean you don't deserve a village? That means you don't deserve to find your people. You don't deserve to have support and love. Well, of course you do. So it takes a village is where I kind of like to chop off that proverb, because we're all entitled to that, no matter how we design our lives. And it was really during COVID that I looked around our environment and thought, gosh, on a global scale, and how often can you say this, Nate, on a global scale, we know what it all feels like to lose our support systems, to lose our people. And I'm not talking about losing them to COVID, but you know, the world shut down. So all of a sudden, everything was ripped away from us in terms of that support, in terms of that village. And so during COVID, it really started me thinking about, again, that proverb, it takes a village, but also hearing from so many people, especially parents, you know, where is the phone number to call for this village? Where's the roadmap for this village? Do these people just show up at your front door, like with a casserole ready to help you? And so I thought, you know what? We do need to create a roadmap for this village. We need to create a roadmap for connection, because one thing we did learn on the other side of COVID was that people didn't really know how to connect, even if they did before COVID. After COVID, it was even worse. We went into, you know, mental health crisis and a loneliness epidemic, and we're not seeing necessarily the traction attached to the recovery of that like we would have hoped it would have happened after COVID.
You don't have children. Is that correct?
No, I don't. I don't. Would love to one day, but I feel like I've been the mother to many.
So I'm wondering, because you led with that when I asked you how this all came about, and you led with, just because you don't have kids doesn't mean you can't have a village. I'm wondering, if you had children, would you have even gone this route about the village and gone down this path?
You know, it's a very good question, Nate. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before, whether or not I would have focused on that. I've always been very intrigued by connection and the different forms of it in our relation, in our relationships, just in our personal ecosystems. But would I have put such a spotlight on it? Probably not, because I think it was in the very unique position that I had, not having children, but also having been a nanny for so many years in my life and having been a part of raising a lot of different children, it gave me, again, that kind of customized perspective about both sides of the fence. I feel like I'm able to straddle that in a really unique way.
What did nannying teach you about children in general? I mean, was there a common theme across the board with all of your kids that you said, wow, this is something that I could take with me once I'm a parent? Or was it not that simple?
There were many lessons, but I'd say the one that is jumping out in my brain right now that I think most parents out there will probably relate to is the idea of competition and guilt with the nanny. And this was something, waters that I navigated and swam the whole time. Because oftentimes when I was coming in to the family, the parents were so happy that I was there. They were happy that they were able to have this support system in their life, but they felt guilty about the time they were spending away from their children. And they also got nervous when they started seeing how their children were attaching to me. And it made them feel, again, like they were bad parents because, you know, they love this other person, what, more than me? And the example I give to that is I was working for a family. It was their first child, little daughter. She was going back to work, the mom. And I was leaving one day and her daughter was crying as I was getting ready to go out the door. And I could see the mom's face just drop and her heart just hit the floor. And I looked at her, my employer, and I said, she is going to be fine in 1 minute after I walk out the door. I said, this is not that serious. You know, this is, did not mean you're a bad parent. This does not mean she doesn't love you. What I want parents to understand is when you feel that guilt or that competition come up with whomever you have helping take care of your children, could even be grandparents, just because they love them doesn't mean they love you less. And if you can start thinking in your life, you know what, if I can surround my child with as much love as possible, that's only going to benefit them. So thinking about your child having a relationship with an aunt or an uncle or a godparent or something like that, you'd want to foster that. So think about that the same way you would a nanny. And I'd say that was one of the biggest lessons I probably learned as a nanny, was I had to be very, very sensitive and cognizant about how the parents were feeling about the bond I was creating with their child or their children.
There's several things there. There's several layers that we could really dig into. I want to just touch on maybe one or two of them. The first thing is the nature versus nurture argument, because what you're telling me is based on your experiences, while nature is clearly important, boy, nurture may be even more powerful, because at least at the ages that you had these kids, these young kids, just because you weren't the quote unquote mom,
right,
they felt a extreme level of comfort, security, affection with you, almost to the point, it sounds like, where they wanted you more than their own mom or you more than their own dad. And to me, that paints a picture about how powerful a human connection is, regardless of whether you're related or not.
Absolutely. I mean, nature nurses versus nurture, you look at that even just in adoption. You know, we have a lot of adoption in our family, lots of cousins and things like that. And it's funny to watch, you know, your cousins have the same exact like personality or mannerisms as their parent. They were adopted. And you're just like, gosh, it's so strong, the nature nurses versus concept. But to go back to what you're talking about, the bond though created with those children, I'm not their parent. So it also relieves the children of that type of obligation to me in the way that they have with their parent. And it also relieves me of that too. I know that I'm walking a fine line. I have to talk about discipline and authority with their parents and make sure that we're all on the same page about that, because that's where you get into trouble as a nanny is, you know, you think you're going to be disciplining or punishing or things like that, and it's not in line with the parents' expectations of you. And so that's a whole different thing. But regarding my bond with them, I also, as a nanny, and also other nannies out there will tell you, or caretakers in general, we see a different side of your children sometimes. Sometimes we see things that you don't, because they're willing to show us that, because we're not their parent. And it becomes safer for them in that way. Not that they don't love you or feel safe with you, but there is something different and less threatening about it when it's someone who is not your family member.
That makes total sense, Florence Ann. And in fact, parents need to realize, I would assume that this wasn't every parent that you dealt with, I think parents need to realize, I'm not here to be my children's best friend. My child doesn't need to look at me as their favorite absolute person on planet Earth.
Right.
It's a completely different relationship that I, as the parent, I, as the authoritative figure, I, as the one that's ultimately responsible to raise this child under my roof, under my rules, and shape them into their adulthood. Yes, I have nanny. I've got Florence Ann, who's tremendously helpful. But at the end of the day, this falls on my shoulder. I have a completely different role. Absolutely. I find it, I don't know what the right word is, but I find it somewhat as a character flaw, we'll say, for that these parents to have that kind of guilt and competition reaction that you mentioned towards you.
It's funny that you say that. I just had this conversation with one of my girlfriends the other day about her kids. And she was saying to me, she really wants to be their friend. And her kids are like 6 and 4. And even that 6 and 3, I think. And I said to her, you know, without criticizing her, I was like, but you know, is that the season of your life that you're in right now with your kids being their friend? You know, that's usually the payoff in the end, getting to be your child's friend when they become adults, you know. I remember my mom, this is back when Friends was on the air, and for a long time, mom didn't want me watching, you know, a lot of different sitcoms that were on, but I got to an age where I could watch it. And I remember her coming in one day while I was watching it, and she sat down next to me, and I could feel like me tense up, like, oh my God, she's going to get mad at me, or what's she going to do? And she sits down next to me and she's watching, and she laughs out loud at something, you know, a scene. And I remember in that moment, will never forget thinking, oh my gosh, my mom is cool. And I didn't think up until that point there was any way my mom was cool, because she was busy raising me, you know, with the values and the guidance that I needed as a child. But we were starting to get into that payoff, that reward season of our lives together. But I agree with you that there's something going on with society today, in parenting especially, where I think the pendulum swings. It was too far at one point where maybe you were too hard on your kids, And now we've swung to the other side. And now, great. Like, where's the happy medium?
Correct. I tell my daughters too. I mean, I said, guys, you can get mad at me. If I didn't care, if I didn't care about your future, my oldest is 13. If I didn't care about your future, if I didn't care about what's going on in your day to day, what's with the boys and this and that, I wouldn't say a word. Go ahead. Have a free for all. Have at it. I said, I'm only saying this stuff to you because I want to make sure you end up being healthy, being secure, knowing right from wrong. We'll be friends. We'll have our drinks together when you're 25, 30. We'll be friends then, right?
Right.
What's your relationship today, Florence Ann, with your mom?
She's my best friend in the world. Yeah, you know, and she, I'm the oldest of four. And I have two sisters and a brother. My brother is only 17 months younger than I am, and he has autism. So our family's had a lot of different layers to it, you know, having a special needs sibling. And my parents were married for 40 years, 40, and got divorced 4 years ago. And you never think that's going to happen in your adulthood, you know, and they still get along very well. And, you know, I'm lucky in that regard. But my relationship with my father is very different than my relationship with my mom. My mom was the caretaker. My nana and papa were my other parents. You know, my dad was a little more absent, but you know, that's because he was working. So those are the sacrifices that were made, you know, on his end. But my relationship with my parents are both very different, but my mom is my everything.
Did you watch, what's that show on Netflix? Love on the Spectrum.
Oh, love that show.
I can't turn that damn show off.
I know. It's ridiculous. It's just the cutest thing.
Holy cow. How do you, do you relate to some of those families with what you've gone through with your brother?
Sure. You know, I sometimes feel a little envious because my brother, Michael, is low functioning on the autism spectrum. And so he would never be able to have a relationship or get married or do anything like that. He really has the mental development and capacity of a toddler. But he's the most gentle, like over 6 feet tall, big guy, just a, you know, just our little earth angel and just like so much of him to love and so docile and sweet. But certainly, you know, when you hear from the family members or the neurotypical, you know, family members, and now I'm not just talking about the show, but in life in general, it definitely makes me relate because they say to know one autistic person is to know one autistic person because every one of them is so different in their own way.
Well, the show paints that picture too. Correct.
Right. I mean, it does.
Look at how
it
different does. all those people are.
It does, you know, but then the common denominators too. But certainly, yeah, I think I look at it sometimes and think, gosh, what it would be like to have seen Michael be able to have a relationship like some of these people do.
So as an autistic man now, who is Michael's village?
Michael is the luckiest. His birthday was actually just yesterday. He turned 37.
Florence Ann, now we know how old you are.
But anyways, I'm 38.
Go ahead.
I am. I'm 38. Yeah, that's right. That's fine. I'm more than happy for anyone to know. except my parents all forgot how old I was. My dad said my brother turned 38 yesterday. I said, no, he's 37. My mom's like, you're 39, right? I'm like, no, I'm 38. I'm
like, you're like, hey, Ma, don't rush it. Give me another year.
I know. Please. Don't rush it. 40. I'm knocking on 40's door. And I'm like, all right, that's enough. But, you know, I love that question of who's Michael's village. You know, Michael is so lucky in that we do have such a tight family. We have cousins, we have friends, you know, all that kind of surround him. And my best friend, for example, my best friend, Annie, she's Michael's age. She takes him out 4 days a week. They go to the museums together and run, you know, on the track together. And it's a beautiful thing to see my best friend have such a big piece of my brother's heart. And you see him almost every day. I'll say to Michael, I love you, Michael. And he'll look at me and go, love you, Annie. I'll look at him and he'll go, love you, Florence Ann. You know, so you know that he loves her so much and he feels that love and that comfort. And we see that in so many different ways with Michael in our family, where he is comforted by lots of different people.
Oh, that's beautiful. So let's dig into some of the meat and potatoes of your book. You talk about attachment styles. Isn't that a main theme throughout?
Yes. Yes.
Talk to us about the attachment styles and kind of maybe give us a little bit on each one.
Well, it's funny because people think attachment styles only relate to romantic relationships. And in friendships, you have an attachment style too. And the two that I like to focus on generally are the anxious and the avoidant. And the anxious attachment style, think about like, oh gosh, I haven't talked to this person in a while. I wonder if they're mad at me. I wonder if they still like me. I wonder if we even still have a friendship. That's where those questions come into play. And then there's the avoidant. When you are a bit more independent and you want to keep a little bit more of a wall up. You want to keep more of that arm's length from someone because you don't want to overwhelm your friends by demanding too much of their attention necessarily. But then both of these attachment styles have a waterfall effect. They lead to different consequences. And I think that's where our work begins in terms of figuring out what is the healthiest connection and attachment style for us.
So somebody that's anxious by default. Mm-hmm. First of all, how do you define attachment style? What does that even mean?
You have to think back to when you were a kid. I mean, that it begins then, you know, kind of, you know, based on your interactions with your caregivers and the type of, you know, what type of child you were, your temperament as a baby, and the influences our feelings and thoughts and behaviors had during our childhood that then permeate our adulthood.
Are we talking attachments to other humans when we say attachment style, or can mm-hmm. it be other things outside of a human connection? Or you're talking specifically human connection?
I'm talking specifically human connection, but I also think environment has a lot to do with our attachment styles too. You know, if you grew up in a toxic environment, perhaps there was alcohol or drug abuse or abandonment for whatever reason, all of that environmental influence is going to affect your attachment style too. So it's the whole umbrella.
Okay, so let's go through each. You started with anxious and avoidant. Was that the
anxious and avoidant? Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So let's go through somebody who's by default become an anxious, has an anxious attachment style.
You're going to be highly attentive to your relationships. You're going to want to address issues immediately because you're worried about how that person's feeling, or you're worried about your place in that person's life. And the downside to that, you know, being anxiously attached is unintentionally pushing people away because you need that constant reassurance from them. And then that makes you go down this rabbit hole of anxiety, trying to evaluate where these feelings are coming from. So that anxious style, sometimes you can sabotage your relationships because
so you're and you're pointing out that these attachment styles are hindering a lot of people from creating a village. Is that basically what we're saying?
Yes. But you know, we could go down an entirely different path with that too. You know, the village that you currently have, and I don't want to get us off the path here too much, but in order to kind of figure out who you need as your villagers, I talk about in the book, these six archetypes of villagers that you look for. And what I challenge you to do is figure out, well, who do I currently have in my village? What's currently working for me? And then once you do that, then figuring out, well, what am I missing? Where am I missing it? Are my friendships actually the right ones aligning with me and my values? Do I have the right people sitting in the right seats, or do I need to shuffle the deck a bit? Am I setting my friendships up for success? So this also goes under this umbrella of attachment styles, because for all of those six archetypes, that is going to be a different need that they are fulfilling. And you, as a villager in other people's villages, are going to be creating and fulfilling a need.
I see. So let's go. Okay, let's go there then. Let's go to the six archetypes. What are they?
This is my favorite part, because people always say to me, well, which is your favorite? I'm like, do you have a favorite child? I don't know if I can give you my favorite archetype. But
well, it depends on the day of the week, right?
Right, the day of the week. I agree. So accepting, dependable, cheerleader, communicator, organizer, and healer. And I went through that fast, Nate, for a reason. Anytime I say those six words to people, I can see their faces start to already automatically start to cast people in roles in their life with just context clues. And that's the fun of it. That's exactly what I want people to do, is start casting people into these roles. Now, I have my definitions of what I think these six archetypes are and how to apply them to your life. But that is part of what we're doing here in building the village, is you're casting it like a movie or a play. These are your main characters.
Okay, tell us briefly, tell us your definitions of each.
So accepting, I always talk about this being the non-judgmental one. It's probably the first person you're going to cast. You think about this as the person that is going to, that you can confide in with a problem or confess a secret to.
Okay. Everyone always has that person that comes right to their mind right away, right? Everyone's got at least one or two at the top.
That you know you're going to, you can tell that secret to. You absolutely probably have that person right away. Dependable. I always say this is your emergency contact. And then I laughed because it's like someone who's going to answer their phone. It's like you're in, like in a ditch somewhere. No one answers their phone anymore. So
there you go. So I do.
So I'm like 20 people's emergency contacts. Like any school, I'm usually their kid's emergency contact because they know I'll answer my phone. Then your cheerleader. And I love this one because, yeah, it gives you that feeling of that, like, you know, rah, rah. But it's more than that. It's your hype person, usually in moments of transition in your life, the one that's going to inspire you when you're making a life change. And your communicator, they have your best interest in mind. They're curious and even tempered. They're capable of seeing other perspectives. That's very big. The organizer, the person you can delegate to. It's peace of mind to release control to them. And then the healer, the one that walks next to you through whatever the it is in life. And this is an important caveat to that. It doesn't mean that they're there to fix you or fix your situation. Walking next to you through something is very different than them being the person that needs to fix it. And I think that's where we get into trouble with a lot of our relationships, romantic or otherwise, is we look to other people for our happiness or to fix us.
Mm. Can you have more than one person in each category?
You can have, and this again too, you know, people get nervous, like, I don't have all six of these people. I don't have a village. I only have three out of the six. Well, you know what? Right now in your life, that may be all you need. You may have five different dependable villagers and four communicators, but you don't have any healers. But right now in your life, you don't see the need for it, or it's not the season of your life that you need it. For example, sometimes these villagers will pop up depending on circumstance. What if you have lost something in your family? It's lost someone, you know, in terms of death, or lost someone in terms of divorce or breakup. Maybe there are going to be people, villagers, that come to your aid at that time. And those are going to be your healers during that time of grief or transition for you. But then as the healing happens, maybe those people will start to pull back. And it doesn't mean if they don't stay that they're not valuable or they weren't valuable to you. It just means that their time or season in your life has completed. And that's okay too.
Mm. Is there one of the six archetypes that's more important than the rest? Like if you don't have this one, it's really hard to have that village that you're seeking.
Depends again on the season of your life. I would say if you are a young parent and you are just filled up to the hilt with responsibility and exhaustion and work, I think a dependable person at that point is going to be very important to you. Delegation will be very important to you because you are going to need help. And so I'd say that person or those people are probably going to be more valuable to you in that, again, season of life.
Gotcha. So then you're saying that you first tell people, put certain people in these buckets, these six categories.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they go from there? Are you then going to those attachment styles to see how they may be negatively impacting them, or are you going somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, you could go to those attachment styles, but I would say more specifically, let's say you cast those people and you're like, all right, I've put all the people in the categories that I believe I've cast them in. Then I want you to evaluate those relationships that you have that you've just cast into those archetypes. Maybe there's a couple of friends that are failing you a lot or are depleting you or are somehow not making you feel joyful. You need to think about why that's happening. And maybe it's not that they're bad friends. Maybe it's just that you've cast them into the wrong role. Maybe you've told them secrets and you found out through the grapevine and other friendship groups that maybe they've spilled those beans to people. And you're like, well, don't love that. You know, that's a betrayal. And I thought I could trust them. But maybe they are one of those people in your life that you know you can pick up the phone and say, I am just down with the flu. I cannot get my kids today, but you're going to be there. Would you mind scooping them up? And they go get the kids, give them, you know, a snack, you know, in the car on the way home and you know you can depend on them to help you in that way, but not depend on them to tell that secret to.
Wow, but it's that's up interesting. To
you, right?
That's interesting because we look at all of our relationships as exactly. You want to treat every person with the exact same criteria in general. I think we all do that, right? And you're right. Coming in and saying, hey, you got to be more precise with your relationships and who you're delegating with, you know, who are you sharing with? Who are you delegating? Everyone could play a different role. Just because someone doesn't know how to keep a secret doesn't mean that they're not dependable.
Right.
And that's what you to figure out.
That's up to you to figure out. And I'm sorry if, you know, you get burned in the process of, you know, figuring this out with your friendships, but that's part of life. You know, we do sometimes have to have trial and error, and we do have to sometimes allow people to show us who they really are. And the only way to do that is by participating in a relationship with them that allows you to both reveal the parts of yourself that are vulnerable or honest.
That reminds me to equate that to a business analogy. That reminds me of the Jim Collins Good to Great, and finding
good to great.
The right people, mm-hmm. right? The right seat on the bus. You could have someone in your organization that's just in the wrong seat. Doesn't mean mm-hmm. that they're not a good person or a valuable person to the organization. You just have them in the wrong place. That's exactly what this reminds me of.
That's exactly, Nate, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what this is. You have the right people sitting in the right seats, and you can apply that, you know, corporate mentality to it as well. But again, the common denominator there, though, corporate or friendship, is setting people up for success.
Right. So then what about the other two? I know we're bouncing around, but what you mentioned those other two attachment styles. What about secure and fearful?
Well, the secure and fearful, you're going to find usually kind of as the subtext of both of those, with avoidant and anxious.
Oh, okay.
And again, these kind of spider off, I would say. But the fearful part of it usually is coming from vulnerability. And it's being nervous that you are going to let that guard down, that you're going to let someone in that way, that they're going to see you maybe more deeply than other people have. And you worry about allowing people to see you like that, because are they going to use it against you? Are they going to betray you? So there's the fear in vulnerability that comes along with that. But then security, there's the positive and negative. There's the insecure, where you're, again, going back to anxious. You're worried about how that relationship is being tested. If you're not talking every day, does that mean we're not really best friends? But then there's the security of knowing that some of these friendships that you have, that you don't talk every day, not even every week, maybe not even every month, but when you do get the chance to see each other, you pick up right where you left off. You hear people say that all the time. There's a security that comes in that. But the only way you get to these secure, healthy attachment styles is the honesty about what you need, and not being afraid to also ask for what you need, but also being a good listener and understanding that you also are part of this relationship with that other person, and you have to allow them the chance to tell you how it is that you can best show up for them.
So, okay, somebody reads your book, Build Your Village. We've linked it here in the show notes. And they say, okay, great, I've got my 6 to 10 people. Everyone's in a bucket. I've got my village. Yay, I did it, Florence Ann. Now my life's going to be great.
Yeah.
So what are you hoping that these people accomplish? They have their village. They do all the things. How does that translate to everyday life?
I hope that people realize that not everything is permanent. And what you have right now, the village that you have right now, may not be the same village a year from now, even 10 years from now. People may, again, you're going to shuffle the deck. You're going to put people into different seats. You're going to fire some people from your village. Your village is going to burn down for reasons that you could never control. And that's why coming back to hopefully a book like mine is evergreen in nature. It can always be an anchor for you, that, you know, no matter what happens in the out of control way, our lives, you know, tend to spiral off sometimes, that you have a place to come back to continue to work these steps and say, no matter what age I am, season of life I'm in, I know that I can always find my people and find my village if I come back to this place and do this work.
How's dating life for you in Chicago? Are you single?
I am. Dating life is terrible. Do you know any wonderful men in Chicago, Nate?
I don't think I do. I don't think I. They're probably too old and boring for you. Who knows? But I'm just curious. Like, what? Why do you think that is? Is it because you're so analytical? Are you too intimidating for these men? I mean, you're very cultured. You're worldly. You're introspective. I assume that intimidates a lot of these people.
Men.
Yes. Well, I didn't want to. I don't know if I can call them men.
No, these boys. So these boys.
I think that's the right term. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a relationship a couple years ago that ended, and it was a good thing that it ended. And since then, I've been trying to dip my toe back into the dating pool. But I would say the older I get, just like most people, you become a little bit more set in your ways. You become a little more specific about the things that you want and what your deal breakers are. And I always say I haven't gotten to this place in my life to just settle. I don't want to do that, you know, until I always joke with my girlfriends and say, until I find someone whose company I enjoy more than my own, I'll stay single. Thanks so much. I wish I had a reason for why it's so hard. I have a sister too, who's 5 years younger than I am. And she also is having a bear of a time in the dating world here in Chicago too. Again, I think the pendulum has swung the other way where, you know, men used to court you and woo you and, you know, kind of put the effort in. Now we're in this digital dating world where they just swipe, 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 and they get bored with you after a few minutes and they find someone else in the revolving door of women and, you know, they ghost you.
Yeah. Well, that's to me has become the absolute downfall to society. I mean, social media has a lot of perks.
Sure.
But the dating apps and how accessible we all are to each other within 2 seconds on any app. It doesn't have to be a dating app. It's completely destroyed chivalry. It's destroyed romance. It's destroyed people knowing how to treat each other. It's a terrible thing. But do you think that you have an attachment style? When you look introspective, do you have an attachment style that may be, you know, preventing you from finding your true love?
It could very much. It's going to be something I'm going to chew on the rest of the day, Nate, now that you said that. I'm going to be thinking about that. It could. I would say I probably lean more toward avoidant just because of my independence.
Right. That's where I was thinking, actually. Yeah, I was going to ask you.
Yeah. And
that.
Yeah, I would, I believe in love. I believe in relationships. And again, I was raised in an old school Italian house. So like, I like that idea, right.
And you know how to take care of kids. I'm sure you're itching to take care of your own at some point.
I would love to. I would. I really would love to. So my nickname is Aunt Lo. My friends' kids all call me Aunt Lo. And so I keep saying, I'm like, I'm looking for not the promotion, because I think being an aunt is beautiful in and of itself, but I would love a different role other than just being Aunt Lo. I'd like to be mom one day too.
No
and
doubt.
Wife. I would like to do that too. So other things I would like to do too than just have the role of Aunt Lo.
Well, it'll undoubtedly come. Unfortunately, there's a lot of boys out there as we've already mentioned. So
yeah, we could do a whole different show.
There's a few good men out there. There's a few good men out there.
I'm sure. I'm sure they are. My friends are married to a lot of really good men, so they give me hope. But we could do a whole different show on dating. My God, I could give you an earful on that.
Build Your Village, A Guide to Finding Joy and Community in Every Stage of Life. We've linked that in the show notes. FlorenceAnn.com. That's linked. Where else do you want people to find you on social, on Hinge, on Tinder, wherever you want people to find you?
Yeah, please, if you're on Hinge, let me know that you listened to this podcast. Social, Florence Ann Romano. I answer every DM. I'd like you to think of me as your virtual village. So please never hesitate to reach out.
Well, fascinating stuff, and wishing you nothing but continued success with everything.
You too. Thank you so much. Pleasure.